Welcome to All the Best. I'm Merin Winchester, and this episode we take you into the weird and wonderful world of nerds. The Nerdstar Comedy Gala brought academic all-stars and comic geniuses together for a night of storytelling. All the Best producer Zasha Rosen went along and caught writer and comic Jazz Twemlow contemplating life after a big night out in King's Cross. This story contains adult themes and there is a language warning.
Good evening, you all right? Fine, great. I like events like this because I always know where I sort of fit in. Because you've got, you know, academics and intellectuals talking about topics that, you know, they've dedicated their lives to. Committed, you know, an entire life of academia to. And then me, the before the lowest human analysis. So that's... That's good. But I thought that's an interesting place to start. I thought I would act as a kind of departure point for the whole evening and make you feel good about yourselves for coming here by showing you just the lowest of humanity. My gigs recently have been really nervy because I recently gave up drinking. So, yeah, thank you, audience, there for that. Support group like you, I predict great success. Drinking on stage, not completely. I have a job and I've met people. Of course I'm going to drink. Ridiculous. But, I gave up drinking on stage because I had a really bad gig recently where the audience challenged me to drink whatever they bought for me. Yeah. And me being the consummate professional that I am, said, fuck yeah. So 2 hours later, in the ambulance, an ambulance, that was terrible, wasting a professional's time. Yeah, they dropped me off at my flat, and my flatmate came out to kind of meet me, to look after me, but he just took one look at me and the state I was in. I was kind of, my eyes were lolling in my head, my neck couldn't support my head weight, and I wasn't doing that sort of mother bird tenderly regurgitating food for its young kind of vomiting. I was doing that sort of exorcist insult your mother kind of vomiting. And he took one look at me and fainted. As if the mere sight of me was enough to make anyone looking upon me lose the will to be conscious. It was really weird. So I couldn't be dropped off at my flat. So then... They drove me to the MC's house, the MC who'd been doing I'd done the gig for, right? So they dropped me off there. I woke up in the morning on his couch with one shoe, I don't know why, and a bag, a polythene bag full of with my jacket in it and my innards, which was nice. Now that would have been fine, but I had to walk back. this is awful. I live in King's Cross. So I was walking back at 6 a.m. Holding a shoe and sort of this just dripping shame bag, really. It's just appalling. And normally, because there's usually a group of homeless people outside my front door because I live between McDonald's and the dildo shop, if you know that. Because comedy's going really well. And that's where all the big shots live. And dildo towers. But yeah, usually there's a group of homeless people outside there and they usually harass me, like, oh, give us some money. And in what was one of the most depressing moments of my life, instead of harassing me, they just parted like the ocean. As if welcoming back one of their own. So that was depressing. So I went back into my house. Oh, before that, yeah, sorry, I had to get rid of this dripping shame bag. So I, because I live next to McDonald's and it was 6 a.m. before trash collection, I tossed this bag on this McDonald's pile of trash, right? And then went inside and fell asleep. And I woke up like an hour later, just the worst pain. And patting myself down, I realized I had to call my boss to let him know I was probably going to be late for work. my first day of work at the ABC on television. That was pretty bad. So I patted myself down to try and call him. I realised I'd left my phone in the jacket pocket, in the bag, in the McDonald's trash. So I went outside to collect it. And in the hour that had passed since, the McDonald's people had thrown subsequent trash on top of that trash. So I had to now rummage in this pile. And I was rummaging through it. It was now 7 a.m., slightly warmer, slightly hotter. This pile was now sort of steaming. And just, I became sort of nauseated one more time, and I just couldn't help sort of one final time but just to vomit on the trash. And so I was there. I was there on Darlinghurst Road, rummaging through my own vomit-laden trash pile with discarded, God knows what, cheese-covered dildos that were in there as well from the neighbouring trash from the other shop, the aforementioned. And I was rummaging through, and the unfortunate thing about it was there were some homeless people watching me, and they were really homeless. Like you know in Pirates of the Caribbean when the bad pirates over centuries gradually become part of the ship? It's kind of like that. Like, there was a guy there, like his face was all made of tarmac. There was a woman, her hair was sort of all woven out of kebab lettuce. And he was watching me rummage through this pile. So when I finally removed my iPhone from this pile of trash, they just looked at me like I was Arthur taking Excalibur out of the stone. And now I am their king. But it's awful because, you know, they've made some bad life choices or something, and I've just inadvertently ratified all of them. You know, then there's just now all the homeless people in King's Cross think that if you throw up on trash, it produces treasure. And I have to live with that. Give up drinking is on stage, yeah, but anyway, is a good idea. Like, it is the worst. It's the worst. I heard the Doctor Who music before. It's the worst kind of time travel imaginable, because you drink, you black out, and you wake up in the future, but you're older. So, you know, note to self, if you want to travel through time, don't use a time machine that travels through time at the speed of time. Because that's just aging, isn't it? Yeah. And I'll just finish on the King's Cross for me. It's a bit of a depressing place. So again, well done for being here. I think it does depress me. Like when I'm standing out, sort of sometimes midnight, I have a weird coffee habit. So I'm sometimes drinking coffee at 12 at night, and just seeing girls on their big night out. Like, I mean, looking at you, like you are wearing clothes, which is fantastic, but it's just depressing. Sometimes they're girls on their night out. I just look at them and I wonder what decision went through your mind, what sort of checklist went through your head before leaving home. It seems the only question you've asked yourself is, how can I make my vagina look like denim? Tick. Like, I appreciate that in some parts of the world, women are so oppressed that they have to wear clothes that cover everything apart from here. But that doesn't mean that you, in order to express your Western freedom, should only wear the bit that I can throw away. Ready. Does it go with my eyes? I don't know. Are your eyes made of barely concealed anus? I'm not sure anything goes with that. Really. Anyway, that's, yeah, good. Thank you very much. You've been a wonderful crowd, and enjoy the rest of the evening. Thank you very much. Good night.
That was Jazz Twemlow sharing some very sound advice on time travel and ladies' fashion. You're listening to All the Best, and this episode we bring you stories from the Nerd Star Comedy Gala held in Sydney. Our next story is bound to blow your mind. Simon O'Toole is a research astronomer at the Australian Astronomical Observatory. He has discovered six planets, and he is known as the Planet Hunter. Simon explores the age-old question, is there life on other planets? This story also has a language warning.
Thank you very much. Okay, so tonight I'm going to talk about a little bit about what it's like to be an astronomer. At first, and then I'm going to talk about life, the universe, and everything, mainly focusing on the life and obviously the universe, and, well, I guess everything else just fits into everything. So, really, this is one of the fundamental questions that I get asked. I get asked a lot of questions as a professional astronomer. Well, probably the silliest ones are things like, you get paid to do that? Yes. Did man really land on the moon? Yes. And I guess the fundamental questions, the questions that really get my attention are, is there life elsewhere in the universe? Because that's what people are really interested in. It's a fundamental human question that people are dying to know the answer to. Are there aliens? Not so much UFOs. I don't want to talk about UFOs, really. But is there life in the universe? And I'm just going to actually get straight to the point here and answer that question right now, and then you can all go home and we'll have a great night. So the answer is yes. There is a little bit of a caveat there. It's all about probability. The answer is yes. I think that there is life in the universe. So what we want to know when we're talking about life in the universe is, are there other planets? So Justine said that I've discovered six planets, and I have, and that's really, really great. But none of them are actually suitable to host life, unfortunately. So the real question is, are there planets in the universe, A, and the answer is yes, but B, are there planets in the universe, in our galaxy even, that are suitable to have life? And how do we answer that question? Well, we have to find these planets. And the best way to do that is to go into space. So we go into space and we have something called the Kepler spacecraft. It's a telescope, it's a 1 meter telescope, it looks at a patch of sky very peculiarly in this shape, and that's actually because there are a whole lot of detectors here, a whole lot of camera detectors here, 42, chosen for a reason. We're nerds, astronomers are nerds. So 42 detectors looking at about only 130,000 stars. So in the galaxy, just for reference, there are over 200 billion stars. So we're looking at a tiny, tiny subset of the galaxy. And Kepler is staring at these 130,000 stars for 3.5 years. And in fact, NASA has very recently extended the mission, so it's now looking for 7 years in total. But 130,000 stars for 3.5 years in this patch of sky with these 42 detectors. So how does Kepler find planets? Well, you might remember last year there was a lot of excitement around June when we had the transit of Venus. So Venus passed in front of the sun. Unfortunately, the weather was pretty crap here in Sydney, but a lot of people still got to see it around the world. You know, the obvious question is, does this happen elsewhere? Do planets pass in front of other stars? And of course, it's a tricky alignment question. We actually only see Venus pass in front of the sun it's twice every 130 years. So no one here is going to see Venus pass in front of the sun again. No one here, because the next time is about 120 years from now. Disappointing. So what does Kepler do? When you look at another star, you don't see a nice big disk like you see with the sun. You see a point of light. All the stars are just points of light. They're so far away, you don't resolve it as a little disk. But you can measure the brightness. You can measure the brightness of the star over time. And so this is what Kepler is designed to do with its 42 detectors. So you measure the brightness, this is time in hours, and then as the planet passes in front, the brightness dims a little bit. And then you can get a lot of information from how long it takes to go in front of the disk of the star, and how deep, how dim the star gets, all of these sorts of things. So this is the fundamental thing. It's just called a planetary transit, just like we had a Venus transit. By the way, Mercury also transits very regularly, but no one is really interested in Mercury for some reason. It's probably the next planet to be demoted after Pluto, I'd say. But anyway. So the next question is, we have a whole bunch of planets that Kepler is finding. It's finding these things. How do we then determine if the planet is suitable for life? Well, prior to Kepler, which went into space, we were doing a whole lot of this from the ground, and all of the planets I found were from the ground with our telescope at Siding Spring Observatory in the centre of New South Wales. But the biggest problem was most of the planets we found lay very, very close to the star that they orbit, so they were far too hot. Then a large number of the planets that we found were kind of like had a cometary orbit, so just like Halley's Comet spends most of its time out in the cold depths of space and then spends a very short time whizzing past the sun, and that's why you see it looks like a comet with a tail. These planets spend most of their time out in the cool depths of space, and then a very short time close into their star. So they're either too cool or they're too hot. So what we're looking for is something that's just right. Something here. And of course, astronomers, well, you could call this imaginative or not. And I'd say we are. So we call this the Goldilocks zone. It's the Goldilocks zone because it's just right. So how do we know if a planet is in the Goldilocks zone? It's a region roughly where you couldn't expect, if you had a planet like the Earth, that you would have liquid water on the surface. That's all it is. It's a very, very simple definition. And in fact, Venus lies just inside, in our own solar system, this Goldilocks zone, and Mars lies just outside. So Earth is sort of in the middle, and it's just a bit of a cosmic coincidence that everything else worked out. So what has Kepler found, and what have we found up to now? We've found a whole lot of planets, actually. So what we see here is actually not just a list of planets with a whole bunch of stupid names, because we are not very inventive when it comes to names. We have great names for planets in our own solar system, and we have names for asteroids that are fantastic in our own solar system. But for planets outside the solar system, it gets the survey name. So for example, Kepler is the survey, the number, the order in which the planet was discovered, the star, so Kepler 62, for example, and then we have a letter. So A is the star, and then the first planet that's discovered is B, the second planet that's discovered is C. Can you see where I'm going? So, not very imaginative on the names, but what we really see here is what some people have called the Earth Similarity Index. So what that just means is they've done a whole bunch of calculations and they've said, well, if we look at the size of the planet and what the gravity would be and how close it is to the star, where it lies in this Goldilocks zone, how similar to Earth is it? And Kepler's found the most similar one recently. This was only a few weeks ago. So we're doing pretty well. But Kepler is really trying to find things like Earth, as I said, but how small can you go? And we can actually detect planets the size of the moon. That just sounds like, oh, wow, the planet the size of the moon, but this is about approximately 20 quadrillion kilometres away. So we can find something the size of the moon 20 quadrillion kilometres away. That's 20 followed by approximately 15 zeros, kilometres. Long, long way. So we're doing very well. So what this tells us, well, if you could read that, it would say there is at least one planet for every star in the galaxy. This is what all of this boils down to. At least one planet for every star in the galaxy. you have 200 billion planets, at least. So what we have is also, and this is the most exciting thing, at least one in six of those planets are Earth-sized. So that's 33 billion Earth-sized planets. Now, please tell me that you don't think that there's life on one of those planets. Right, I didn't think so. Okay, there's life on at least one of those planets, other than Earth, of course. We know that one. I'm not talking about intelligent life, by the way. We don't know that. So it would be very remiss of me to come to a Nerd Gala presentation and not talk about Star Wars. But one thing that a few people have asked me, well, could you really have a planet orbiting two suns? Could you have this binary sunset? Could you have Luke Skywalker looking over with the evocative music playing and you get all emotional and all this wonderful stuff? And the answer is actually yes, we've found these kinds of planets. This is one of my favorite things, actually, is that we can now say, yes, Tatooine could be out there. That's kind of awesome. That's kind of awesome. So, you know, I've talked a lot about this, but, you know, there are a lot of people who like conspiracy theories. So, really, what about things like aliens and crop circles and mutilated cattle? Sorry. No, we don't really deal with, well, mutilated cattle. I mean, that's the Midwest of the United States. Come on. But I'm going to say, well, astronomers love our wacky acronyms. This is TESS. It stands for Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. And it's the next thing. And if you think that Kepler's a pretty amazing thing, looking at 130,000 stars, well, TESS, which is going to launch in about 8 to 10 years, if NASA has any money, will look at about 2.5 million stars. So we're going to be finding loads and loads of planets. We won't be going there anytime soon, but it's still going to be awesome. So thank you.
Isn't that amazing? 33 billion planets the size of Earth. So yes, there probably is life on other planets. The vastness of space is extraordinary and there is so much out there that we don't know. Thanks to everyone who contributed to today's show, Jazz Twemlow, Simon O'Toole, and the brains behind the Nerdstar Comedy Gala and Nerd Night in Sydney, Justine Rogers. Today we leave you with a taste of what's to come. Spoken word artist Tug Dumbly reflects on poetry and science. You can catch more from Tug Dumbly next week, and all the best.
Both poetry and science suffer the slings and arrows of grievous cliché. The poet in pop culture is shorthand for a giggle, a yawn, a drunk buffoon, Ned Flanders' parents, or Mike Myers, or some cool hip-swinging daddy-o in a Gidget film, in a beret and stripy shirt reciting pretentious beat twaddle in a smoky bohemian coffee house going kapow, zap, wow, as he clicks his fingers along to bongos and a double bass and a besotted audience of starry-eyed college girls. At least that's been my experience. The scientist, to my mind, will always be Professor Julius Sumner Miller. Why is it so? Why does the toast leave moisture on the plate? You know, dishevelled, crazy hair, thick-rimmed glasses, white lab coat, or eccentric, forgetful, mad like that Back to the Future dude, or a cackling, megalomaniacal genius who can't remember his wife's name but can program a gnat to fly into the president's brain. In the popular imagination, and sometimes fact, the poet and the scientist share method and madness in equal measure, have reputations either as nerds or crazy loner maverick substance abusers, savants who hog big chunks of the autism spectrum. Their work earns scorn for its seeming lack of utility, what's taken for its perverse, eclectic intent to baffle, its twisting corridors of arcane obscurity and mission to preach to a few boffins and pointy heads in the gilded towers of academia. Present company accepted. Pushes to make science and poetry more accessible, fun, digestible to Joe Public, who we are assured is hungering for the stuff like a slavering dog. If only poor old Joe could bloody well understand it. Witness calls to bring poetry back to the people, which makes you wonder who took poetry from the people in the first place, and do the people actually want the fucking stuff? But then if horrible histories can make history popular, then why not a show called Horrible Poetry or Horrible Science? The field is rich with atrocities for your entertainment. Witness the bomb and Pam Ayres. But hey, Joe Public gets his science in the end, though in a form he understands, a tastier, more addictive burger, advertised with a boiled-down legacy of millennia of difficult poetry. Mmm, it's Mac time. I've got the hots for what's in the box with the dots. No, the humanities! Science, poetry, creative fields in general seek and find correspondences in nature, are spawned on naturally occurring perfections of form that are so neat and perfect, so teleologically inevitable that they had to be put there for our discovery, our brain-teasing delectation, our aesthetic pleasure, our utility and convenience. Praise God!
All the Best is produced at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN in Melbourne, Radio Adelaide and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Our production manager is Carly Ann Keneally. Our executive producers are Jordana Caputo and Belinda Lopez. And I'm Meryn Winchester, the features executive producer. Catch us next week for more homegrown stories from around Australia.